Hi, I'm Keegan.
And I'm Madigan.
And you're listening to
Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist.
This is a podcast where we explore the world through our own personal feminist perspectives. And like always, but in particular this week, we just want to reiterate that we are not doctors.
Nope.
We are not experts. And if you are experiencing any of these symptoms or anything that we talk about in this episode, please consult a medical professional. Don't just rely on the things that we're saying.
No,
in our personal
definitely
experience.
Don't do that.
Yeah.
No.
So Madigan is sick.
I'm sick, guys. And my voice sounds so sexy. I'm actually a really big fan of how my voice sounds right now. Definitely speaking in my lower register. I'm talking really close to the microphone so y'all can hear me. And yeah, that's what's up with me today.
In case you were curious.
In case you were curious about this new and improved Madigan.
She'll be back to her old ways, I'm sure, by next episode.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, today, as we said in our mini episode, May is Mental Health Month.
Yep.
And we are going to discuss this issue. Probably could have been split in half. But
yeah,
like we said, we didn't want to overwhelm you. So we are bringing you anxiety and depression today, wrapped up in one neat little bundle.
Yes. Before we go any further, you have two eyelashes on your cheeks that need to have wishes blown on them.
Okay.
I got you.
Excellent.
Okay. Here's one. I'm going to hold that in my hand.
Okay.
And there's the other one. Okay. So make two wishes and blow.
Okay. I have to think about this.
I always wish for the same thing. All right, there you go. Okay, I'm sorry,
Excellent.
Guys. It had to be done.
No, listen, priorities.
Right? Exactly. So, okay. Yes, like she said, we are going to be combining the two together. I think a lot of times they go hand in hand.
They very often go hand in hand, yes.
Yeah, and they're two very, 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 very common things.
Specifically among women, which is why I wanted to do this, both anxiety and depression, women are twice as likely to suffer from.
Yeah, approximately 12 million women in the United States experience clinical depression each year, which is bonkers. And girls 14 to 18 years of age have consistently higher rates of depression than boys in this age group.
Yeah, it's very interesting, actually, because at the age of 11, boys and girls are equally likely to have an anxiety disorder. And that likelihood is usually pretty low. But if you bump that up 4 years, so 15-year-old girls are 6 times more likely than boys to suffer from anxiety disorders or depression.
That's so funny because, like, that kind of follows my, like, diagnosis history. I think
Well, there are reasons.
Yeah, go. Tell me. It helped me learn more about myself, Keegan.
I will. Okay. So there is a nature versus nurture argument when it comes to why women are more likely to suffer from depression.
Right.
So the nature argument says that estrogen and progesterone, which are the female hormones, might make the flight or fight response in women more sensitive, which may manifest in higher levels of anxiety.
Yep.
Additionally, some research suggests that the female brain is unable to process serotonin as effectively as male brains. So essentially, we are not only more likely to be easily pushed into fight or flight mode, but we're also more likely to stay on edge when that flight or fight mode rises than the male brain is. The female brain is also more sensitive to the stress hormone. Okay, hold on. I practiced this. Let's see if I can say it.
You got this.
Corticotropin releasing factor, because testosterone seems to insulate the male brain against these factors. So we don't have as much testosterone, so there's nothing blocking this, like, stress hormone that causes us to be highly anxious.
Yep. Oh, man. Yeah, for me, I was 9 or 10. I forget when I was, like, officially diagnosed with anxiety and a panic disorder. And then I think I was 15 when I was officially diagnosed with depression, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense. And I think that, like, from what I've read, too, because, like, when you're going through puberty, that's when, like, all of those hormones are kind of all over the place.
Which is why you will also likely see a spike in mood disorders, such as depression or anxiety, during other times of hormonal change, like pregnancy or post-pregnancy.
Or even just when you're on your period.
Yeah,
there's PMS versus, like, PMDD, which is interesting to me because, like, I feel like people are always just like, oh, I just have really bad PMS, where, like, really there could be, like, other issues going on.
Yeah, or even postpartum depression can also manifest change into postpartum psychosis, which is another thing that can happen based on, like, your hormonal differences.
Yeah.
And then something else that I found was interesting was because it's so directly linked to your hormones, you can see that the levels of depression or anxiety between men and women tend to level out post-menopause.
Yeah.
So before puberty and after menopause, men and women tend to have the same levels of anxiety and depression. That is the nature standpoint of why women may be more prone to depression, but there is also a nurture standpoint.
Yes. Which would be like stress from work, family responsibilities, roles and expectations of women, such as like sexual abuse or poverty. And I guess that goes for men and women too.
Right.
Where it's just kind of like socially where you are in your life. I know for me, you know, having less money is definitely increased.
Oh, for sure.
You know what I mean? Like
it
definitely is a big factor. So I totally understand that.
Yeah. There are societal or situational issues that can prompt anxiety or depression.
Yeah.
But as far as it being a direct like men and women comparison.
Yeah.
They say that there is this thing called the skinned knee effect that happens with young women or small girls, where it's basically like if a girl was to skin her knee and like run to a parent, she's more likely to be coddled and comforted and validated about her feelings. Whereas if a boy were to do the same thing, he would be kind of told to like
walk it off,
man up. So they're developing these like coping mechanisms.
Yeah.
So this woman, Michelle Kreisk, who's a psychologist, or maybe she's not a psychologist, she's a scientist, and she has a book called Nerve where she talks about the skin knee effect. She says, parents coddle girls who cry after a painful scrape and tell boys to suck it up, and this formative link between emotional outbursts and kisses from mom predisposes girls to react to unpleasant situations with negative feelings like anxiety later in life. On top of this, cultural biases about boys being more capable than girls also leads parents to push sons to show courage and confront their fears, while daughters are far more likely to be sheltered from life's challenges. If little Olivia shows fear, she gets a hug. If little Oliver shows fear, he gets the urge to overcome it. So whether they intend to or not, they treat emotional outbursts from girls just far differently from boys. So like from a socialization angle, there's quite a lot of evidence that little girls who exhibit shyness or anxiety are reinforced for that behavior.
Yeah. Also, women, kind of going off of that, women are more likely to seek help because of that. So it's like if men have depression or things like that, they tend to try to convince themselves that they're okay, that there's not a problem.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
Where women will be like, oh shit, there's something wrong. I have to get this figured out.
Right. So men constitute just 37% of therapy patients, which is shockingly low.
Yeah.
And I have here, troublingly enough, the evidence shows that while women deal with anxiety and stress by worrying, men are more likely to try and bury these feelings with drugs or alcohol, which offers one rationale for why men are at a higher risk of antisocial disorders like alcoholism rather than mood disorders like anxiety or depression.
I was on this website where it was saying like the differences between men and women, and some of them I feel like are kind of like extreme and not like entirely true, where it's like, you know, women with depression will feel more like lethargic and nervous, men are more agitated and reckless, which I mean it can be true, but I feel like it's just very general like statements. Women commonly feel sad, worthless, and apathetic. Men tend to feel angry and irritable. Women blame themselves, men blame others. Women feel anxious and scared, men feel guarded. So I feel like it's a very like blanketed statement, but I found it interesting just to read to see, like...
I agree that I think it's very generalized, but I also think that from a societal standpoint, that's what they teach you. Yeah, been reinforced in us, it wouldn't surprise me if that is how it manifested differently in men and women, not because of our genetic makeup, but because of our cultural...
Yeah, and this one, it says, women tend to talk about their feelings with ease, and men have self-doubt and despair and consider depression a sign of weakness, and I think that's definitely true. Like, you and I can talk about our experience.
Absolutely.
Where I feel like it's way less likely for like two dudes to get together and be like, man, I've been feeling these things lately. And
yeah.
I mean, if they do, bravo. I think that would be amazing if men could talk to their fellow man like that.
Yeah, I would like to have a whole nother episode just on mental health and like depression and situations like that within communities of color, because I feel like especially for men in like Latino and Black cultures where there's so much like machismo and bravado and like masculine energy and this is what it means to be a man, that they really don't seek help at all for any kind of like mental issues they may be struggling with.
Yeah. I've definitely kind of witnessed some of that, experienced it myself. My parents were great about, you know, the second that I was having problems, my mom was like, you need to get into therapy, and well, we're going to talk more about medication a little bit later, because that's a whole other problem. I thought it was interesting that sometimes people will, depression typically isn't misdiagnosed, or anxiety usually isn't misdiagnosed, but sometimes it can be hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, because those symptoms can be very, very similar. Thyroid disorders affect an estimated 20 million Americans and are 5 to 8 times more common in women than in men. And like I said, anxiety and depression have been associated a lot with thyroid disorders. Mm-hmm. And hypothyroidism, which is an underactive thyroid, has similar symptoms of depression, where hyperthyroid syndrome can very much mimic the symptoms of anxiety, which I think is interesting.
Mm-hmm. So I think we should maybe just, like, throw out what the definitions of depression and anxiety are.
Go for it, Caitlin.
According to the American Psychiatric Association.
Yes.
So depression, or major depressive disorder, because there is a difference between feelings of being depressed, which I think a lot of people suffer from that, and clinical depression, or major depressive disorder. And it is a common and serious mental illness that negatively affects how you feel, the way you think, and how you act. Fortunately, it is also treatable. Depression causes feelings of sadness and or loss of interest in activities once enjoyed. It can lead to a variety of emotional and physical problems and can decrease a person's ability to function at work and at home. Depression symptoms can vary from mild to severe and can include feeling sad or having a depressed mood, loss of interest or pleasure in activities once enjoyed, changes in appetite, weight loss or gain unrelated to dieting, trouble sleeping or sleeping too much, loss of energy or increased fatigue, increase of purposelessness or slowed movements and speech, actions observable by others, feeling worthless or guilty, difficulty thinking, concentrating, or making decisions, thoughts of death or suicide. And it is a mood disorder, and it is different than a minor setback or disappointment in your day. It's different than bereavement grieving. It's different than just being sad.
Yeah.
I think that that's something that needs to be addressed.
That's something that, like, really grinds my gears is when people kind of throw that word around.
Oh, I'm so depressed.
Like you said, you can be depressed for, like, short periods of time, but it's just kind of like, I feel like it's become such a blanketed statement again, or like almost like a like it's in.
Right. I think that there is a certain thing about using mental illnesses or mood disorders and kind of throwing it around in everyday language, like, I'm so OCD, or like, I'm so bipolar right
now.
Yeah,
exactly.
You know, where it's just like, there are people who actually suffer from these disorders.
Right.
And it's not helpful to kind of, like, throw it around like that.
Right. And I think for me, when people throw around the, like, oh, I had a panic attack.
Oh, that's really...
That's the one for me that is more so than just, like, I'm depressed. Because, like, you can be depressed without having depression.
I think sometimes people just have a difficulty with language and not understanding that there's a difference between being depressed and being sad. And so I think that they're just trying to put in words, I'm really sad right now, when they're saying that they're depressed. But a panic attack, which I have a whole thing on panic attacks in my notes, a panic attack is something that's very, very specific. And it's not just feeling... It's not nerves.
Yeah.
Like, I think...
And it's not, like, over stress. It's not... Mm-hmm. I mean, stress can help spur them, but it's different than just, like, a feeling of being overwhelmed and stressed and actually having a panic attack. That, for me, that was one that, since I was really young, like, really annoyed me when people would overgeneralize.
Right. So, okay, panic attacks. You've had panic attacks. I've had panic attacks. Panic attacks are a anxiety disorder.
Yeah.
So it's not a depressive state. It's an anxiety disorder.
Yeah. So can I, before you share, like, what it actually is, can I share what my first one was?
Yes.
Because it's like, I remember the first panic attack. Well, I think I had, like, mini ones before when I was younger, but this one, man, like, stuck with me. So I had separation anxiety from my mom when I was little, like, really bad.
Which,
like,
is another anxiety disorder.
Yeah, it is. And so whenever I wasn't with her, my mind would just concoct these horrible ways of my mom dying. I had horrible nightmares. I was so scared of being without her that I would, or that she would die and I would be by myself, basically, that I would panic and I would have to leave school, and it was just a whole thing. So I walked home from school and I had my friend Alexis with me. And I went to open the door and it was locked. And my door, like, we never locked the door when my mom was home. It was always open. And so I just remember, like, jiggling the door handle and my friend Alexis being like, okay, let's just go play in the backyard and wait. And I just, like, remember it being like the world was spinning around me and, like, I couldn't see straight. And I was, like, pacing, like, in the backyard looking for her, like, screaming her name and then, like, going to the front yard and doing the same. And apparently it took 7 minutes from that time to my mom being home, and it was like, it felt like it was 2 seconds and it felt like it was 2 hours at the same time. And like, I couldn't breathe, and I'm 10 years old, and my friend Alexis is like, I don't know what to do. And it's so bizarre because I remember it was St. Patrick's Day because we were wearing like St. Patrick's Day themed shirts to school or whatever. And like, my mom got home and she was like, I'm so sorry, I hit every red light, you know, I just, it took me longer than I thought to get home. And I just remember, like, just sobbing, but just being so disoriented. Like, I remember it so vividly, yet I don't remember much of anything because it was like I was in a tornado or something. Like, everything was just spinning.
If you are sitting here wondering if you've ever had a panic attack, you probably haven't had a panic attack.
Yeah.
Because you know when you've had a panic attack.
It feels like you are having a heart attack.
It feels like you're having a heart attack.
And you are dying. I've literally called 911 on myself before because I remember, like, I was, like, 19, too. Like, I had had panic attacks for almost 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I was on the floor of my apartment in North Hollywood, and I was like, I am dying. This is what dying feels like. Well, I had my eating disorder at the time, too. So I was like, this is it. I'm done. I'm dying right now. So I called 911, and they were like, this sounds like a panic attack. I was like, no, you don't understand. I'm dying. This is a heart attack. I'm dying. Like,
right.
It felt like my heart was, like, beating out of his chest.
That's actually a common symptom of panic attacks, is feeling like you're having a heart attack. Almost everyone will say that that is a common thing that you experience.
Yeah.
So let's go into what happens to your body when you are having a panic attack. So when you are confronted with danger, adrenaline is released in your brain, and you can either fight, you can fly, or you can freeze. So it's that fight, flight, or freeze response that happens. When you're having a panic attack, your flight response is activated in the same way it would be if you were being physically attacked.
Yeah.
So you are confronted with danger the same way you would be if somebody was coming at you with a knife, essentially. Yeah. But there is no discernible reason you should be experiencing intense feelings of fear and panic. So sufferers of panic attack often feel that they're mentally unstable when they're having them, and they feel like they're experiencing a heart attack. So symptoms include heart pounding, shaking, dizziness, sweating, choking feeling, nausea, shallow or short breath, chest pain, numbness or tingling, chills and hot flashes, feelings of unreality, feeling like you're going crazy, feeling like you're going to die.
Yeah.
And if you have four or more of these symptoms, you are likely suffering from a panic attack. And if you have four or more panic attacks within 4 weeks, you may have panic disorder.
Yeah. And that was, man, when I was in fifth grade, it was all the time. Because, like, my mom worked at school, and then she would leave, and I would, like, I would start panicking, and I would literally feel like I was sick. I would go, and I would say, I need to go home. And they would, like, keep me in the principal's office and be like, nope, you're not going home, because they knew that, like, I wasn't actually sick. That was the worst thing ever, though. They would, like, lock me in a room.
Right. That's it doesn't help you. And actually, we'll talk some ways in which you can not only help yourself, but also help people around you when they are having panic attacks.
Yeah, but I just don't think they understood, like, what was going on with me. I think they just thought that I was, like,
Overreacting,
a needy child that just wanted their mom, or, you know, like, making things up. And, you know, at times I was, you know, I just was like, I was too scared to have her go. I felt like I needed to go home with her. But, like, obviously I was overreacting, but not in my own head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and they weren't able to, like, understand that.
Well, here's part of it. When you are having an actual panic attack, there's two parts of your brain. There's a sympathetic part and a parasympathetic part. And your sympathetic part of your brain is responsible for your flight or fight response.
Yeah.
When you are having a panic attack, you experience incredible amounts of fear, like actual fear. Like, you're actually scared and your body's reacting to it that way. That's why your heart pounds, your pupils dilate, all of that happens. You can't breathe. And you want to run away, but there's nothing to run away from.
Yeah.
And to make matters worse, the parasympathetic part of your brain, which usually calms you down whenever you're afraid, doesn't work for whatever reason. Yeah. Science doesn't even know why, but the parasympathetic part of your brain doesn't engage whenever you're having a panic attack.
Yeah.
So you're stuck in this heightened state of absolute paralyzing fear, and there's nothing there that's telling your brain to shut it down.
Yeah.
So you basically have to sit in it for as long as it takes until you can come down out of it.
And that's something that, like, my mom always kind of told me was to, like, you know, start listing things around you, start, you know, focusing on your breath, things that, like, kind of keep you centered, and just know, like, she would always be like, just know that it's gonna end and know that it's gonna pass. And for me, as soon as I was able to label it as a panic attack, it was easier for me to, like, understand and, like, wait it out. It still sucked.
Of course.
But I was able to be like, this is a panic attack right now.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing is going to hurt me, and I need to, like, chill out.
Yeah,
I mean, it doesn't happen like that all the time, but
the interesting thing about panic attacks is, like, whenever I've had them, I'm rational enough to say, this is not real.
Yeah.
I'm going to be okay. I just need to, like, breathe. I just need to wait this out. I just need to come out of it.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it any less terrible.
No, it still sucks.
Like, while it's happening.
Yeah. And then for me, well, we were talking about this a couple days ago, where it's like, when it hits us, it's like, we are out for the day. Like,
yeah.
I am done. It feels like I've gotten hit by a bus. I'm in bed. Mm-hmm. I've got, you know, like, that is when I spend the rest of the day just, like, having me time, and, like, I have to cancel everything else and I can't do anything.
The last time it happened to me, I was in bed, and I couldn't sleep. Sometimes I have, like, pretty bad bouts of insomnia. Usually, I'll sleep well for, like, a period of time, and then I'll have a period of, like, weeks or so where I really don't sleep much.
Yeah.
And usually, it's a, because I have high anxiety, and usually from that, I won't be able to sleep because I'll have running thoughts, which is just, like, laying in bed and not being able to shut your mind off
at
all.
That's why I sleep with the TV on when I go to sleep.
I do that sometimes now, too. Or, you know, I'll just, like, take a melatonin or whatever if I know, if I can feel it coming, where I'm just like, I'm not going to be able to shut this down.
I know this isn't, like, a cure for insomnia or anything, but what I do, this is, like, so weird. I've told people this before and they're like, what the fuck? I'll, like, play a show that I know really well, and then I cast my friends in the roles and close my eyes. Yes. And then I play it out in my head, like, my friends are those, like, roles. I don't know, because it distracts me from, like, other things that go on. So, like, if I'm watching the show Friends, I'm like, okay, Keegan is Rachel, my friend Betsy is gonna be Monica, Chris is gonna be Joey, and I'll, like, play it out in my head, and that, like, is something that's easy to think about, and I know the episodes so well that I, like,
It helps
me fall asleep and not, like, be thinking about other things. Like, the other night, Chris turned the TV off before I was, like, actually asleep. And I was like, oh, God, I can't. I'm too tired to get up and turn the TV back on. But, oh, fuck, no.
That's actually funny to me, because for me, sometimes having the TV on makes it more difficult for me to sleep.
Because there's more, like, noises and thoughts.
There's too many thoughts, and then I'm thinking about that.
Yeah.
Where sometimes to turn my brain off, I have to have it be quiet, or just have, like, a fan on or something, some kind of, like, white noise to distract my mind.
Yeah.
But, okay, so the last time I had a bad panic attack, I was in bed, and I couldn't sleep. I was having running thoughts. I could not sleep. I was also on my period, so I was in, like, pain, which can keep me from sleeping, and I just went down this rabbit hole in my brain, which is often what happens to me. I get into running thoughts, and then you go down this pit, and then you start, like, repeating everything that you're doing wrong, everything you don't like about yourself.
And then you think about 10 years from now, and then you're like, oh, God.
Yeah, or 10 years ago, and you're like, oh, wow, I thought my life was going to be so different. And then you start spinning. Spinning out is what happened. I totally spun out, and then I had the worst panic attack of my life. Like, I couldn't breathe. I felt like my heart was racing. Anthony was sleeping. I didn't want to wake him up, but I was shaking. I was having chills, like just hot flashes and then chills. And I was sobbing. I was crying. It was the worst. And eventually, I think I went on like that for about an hour and a half before I finally woke Anthony up. And I was just like, I just need you to be awake with me right now, because like, I was shaking. I was like physically shaking, because I'm just like, I don't know how to get out of this. I don't know how to come down from this right now.
I bet once you were down, though, you slept for a long time.
Well, I didn't go to work the next day.
Yeah.
I called out of work, and I actually, like, downloaded a meditation app.
Yeah.
Because I was just like, I need to, because even whenever I was out of it, so what they say is, your panic attack can last for as little as 10 minutes, but that's not my case. It didn't last for 10 minutes. It lasted for a couple of hours, but the after effects of it can last for another however many hours. Yeah. Like, it can go on for a long time. So even when I had come down from it, I downloaded that meditation app because I was still like, I need help with my breathing. I still feel like I'm not breathing. I still feel like I'm out of sorts. And I needed to do that to focus on my breathing to try and sleep, to try and like get it, like to sleep it out. So here's some things that you can do if you are having an anxiety attack. And these actually mirror, my friend told me, who's who focuses on mindfulness meditation. She's a mindfulness meditation teacher. And she said that these are kind of hallmarks of that as well. Tips to help you with an anxiety attack. Look around. Find 5 things you can see, 4 things you can touch, 3 things you can hear, and 2 things you can smell, and 1 thing you can taste. This is called grounding, and it can help you feel like, it can help when you feel like you have lost all control of your surroundings. And when I read this after I had my last really bad anxiety attack, I'm like, oh yeah, because you don't feel connected. You feel like you're deep sunken in your brain.
Yeah.
And you don't feel connected to the world around you at all.
Yeah.
So you need to touch things to know that like you are in a place, like a real place. You need to like feel things, smell things, taste things to know that you're a person, you're in a place, you're safe.
And it helps you kind of like get your mind off it a little bit too, because you're thinking about something else that's easy to think about.
Mm-hmm. And but I know we've been on anxiety attacks or panic attacks for a long time, so we'll move off of it. But just before we do, things that you should and should not do to someone who is having a panic attack.
Right.
Things that you should not do. Remind your friend of the problem. Make assumptions of what your friend needs. Dismiss your friend by saying, stop panicking. Calm down. You're overreacting. It's all in your head. Or leave your friend alone.
Yeah.
And things that you should do. Take your friend to a quiet corner. Take slow, deep breaths with your friend. Get water and keep your friend cool. Be predictable. Motive your friend in short, simple sentences. Be understanding to your friend's problem. Be patient and seek medical help if needed. Hold your friend till he or she returns to his normal state.
Yep.
So just essentially just be there for them. Be a calming resource for them.
Yeah, just your presence is helpful.
Right, and don't try to convince them. For all of this, for all anxiety disorders, depression, mood disorders, don't try and make them feel like they can will themselves out of it.
Yeah, don't be like, snap out of it.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't work. I've tried it a lot.
So, they found that panic attacks can actually be linked directly, panic disorder, mm-hmm. which is different than people can have panic attacks and not have panic disorder. If you have panic disorder, you have panic attacks. People with panic disorder, it oftentimes leads to another anxiety disorder that we've discussed in the past, agoraphobia.
Yep.
So I know that you told me that your mom suffered from agoraphobia for a little while.
Yeah, she did. I can't remember how long exactly, but I mean, when she had agoraphobia, it didn't exist yet.
Mm-hmm.
They were just like, oh, you're depressed. And she's like, no, I'm not depressed. Like, that's not it at all.
Mm-hmm. I have a fear of agoraphobia, if you don't know, is a fear of leaving the house. It's actually a fear of being in situations where escape may be difficult or embarrassing, so you stay inside.
Yeah, she basically had to, like, get herself out of it. And she was in a mental hospital for, like, 3 weeks, and then she bought a book that she actually gave me when I first started having panic attacks and was diagnosed with anxiety, and it was super helpful. And she like read this book and like did all the research that she could on her own, and then just started doing like tiny little things every day, like, I'm just gonna go to the corner and back, mm-hmm. I'm just gonna go, and then she'd be like, okay, I'm just gonna go pick up a prescription and then come back home.
That's actually amazing that she was able to do that on her own, because that is something that they do with you whenever they're working with you on extreme anxiety disorders.
I think they put her on medication too, so I think that was probably helpful, but she kind of had to like...
But she put herself through exposure therapy, is what that is.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, she knew that like that wasn't how she wanted to live her life, and I really should ask her to tell me that whole story again, because I don't remember a lot of like the details. I just remember her like kind of saying, yeah, that she would like put herself in difficult situations and then just kind of slowly go further and further away to like test it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, Yeah.
Yeah, that's impressive.
It is quite impressive. Go mom.
So I just mentioned exposure therapy, so I guess I'll talk about that for just a moment.
Yeah.
Exposure therapy is something that they do with anxiety disorders in particular, or like behavioral disorders like OCD, like extreme OCD, or you'll see it with like forms of OCD like hoarding and also agoraphobia, where they will expose you to your fear.
Yeah.
Because anxiety, as you'll find, all anxiety disorders, phobias, panic attacks, PTSD, all of these things, they're rooted in fear.
Yeah.
And your body's response to fear. So exposure therapy basically puts you in a position to be exposed to the thing that is making you afraid.
Yeah.
Little by little until you're not afraid of it anymore, basically.
Yeah. Don't just, like, throw a spider at someone who's scared of spiders.
No, don't do that. Definitely go to a professional, or, yeah. I mean, you can do it yourself as Madigan's yeah. mom did, but just beware that you can't, just like with hoarding, we could have an entire episode on hoarders, but with hoarding is something I have a lot of personal experience with in my family, like actual hoarding, not just like I like to hold on to stuff.
Yeah.
With that especially, there's this idea that you can kind of like go in and throw the person's things away.
And then it's all going to be good. No.
And then it's going to fix it because the stuff is the problem, but the stuff is not the problem.
Yeah.
So you can't attack that and think that you're solving the problem, just like you can't throw a spider on someone who has arachnophobia and expect it to solve the problem.
Right. Well, and then, you know, we're going to talk more and more about eating disorders as we go along, but that's another really big misconception, is that it's like, oh, well, this person is eating, or like, let's just give them food and then that will fix the problem.
Right.
And
if I can get their weight back up, then they'll be fine.
Yeah, exactly. Which is, you know, it's part of it. Your brain has to be normal again for you to be thinking rationally, but like, that's not the problem. You know, you have to look deep into, you know, your memories and your psyche and realize like, what is this person going through?
Mm-hmm.
Like, for me, I remember my therapist would have me go on like hour-long outings with my dad just to get me like out of the house for a little bit. And I just remember hating it and being so anxious, but like having to do it. Like every Monday for an hour, we have to like go and get ice cream and like be without mom. And oh my God, it was horrible. And I was just like, okay, I'm trying to enjoy my ice cream.
Yeah. Yeah.
I just remember for me, like, the first time that I was ever on medication was, like, the first time that I was actually able to, like, go through a play date without, like, having to call my mom and freak out. And I think part of it was kind of the placebo effect, too, because I was like, it's fixing me.
Yeah.
But
do you feel like growing up, your anxiety or your depression were more of a hindrance to you, or both?
At different times in my life.
Different stuff.
Yeah. I feel like my anxiety has always been the most prevalent, but as an adult, I feel like I've kind of learned to manage my like day-to-day anxiety, but I still will get panic attacks where it's more so my depression. I feel like I won't necessarily get like intense, well, I will get intense bouts of sadness, but it'll be for no reason at all. My body will hurt. I'll have no energy. I'll have lifelessness. I won't have interest in anything. And especially around my period, it's horrible. And that's another reason why I hate my period so much, because a few days before, it's like I feel like I have a cloud over my head and nothing is ever going to be okay.
So yeah.
Kind of, for me, they've kind of merged into
one.
Almost being the same thing. Yeah,
well,
it's weird.
I mean, they do typically go hand in hand. People who have anxiety typically have a higher likelihood of having depression.
Yeah, one for me too. Like with my depression, it would lead to me being anxious about it, and then I would have to try to. I would choose horrible ways of trying to like calm my anxiety. You know what I mean?
That's funny, because for me, I feel like it's the opposite. Like for me, I feel like when my depression is at its worst, it comes from my anxiety. Like, it's me being, like, highly, highly, highly anxious.
Uh-huh.
And then feeling like I just need to shut all of this down. Like,
yeah.
And so the only way, there's, like, no middle ground. When I'm highly, highly anxious, there's no middle ground between being anxious and being depressed or having feelings and dealing with those feelings in a healthy way. I just shut all of them off.
Yeah.
So then I'm depressed.
Oh, I just overfeel everything and I, like, have a panic attack.
Yeah.
I start, well, like, crying and hyperventilating and, like,
I think I
laying
fear,
on the floor.
I fear panic attacks so much.
Yeah.
Which is actually why panic attacks lead
to agoraphobia. Yeah, exactly.
It's why they lead to agoraphobia.
Or just lead to having a panic attack because you're scared of having a panic attack.
Yeah, and that's actually true, too. Like, that, they can't pinpoint a trigger for what causes panic attacks, but that is one of them.
Yeah, I'm sure it's just different in everybody. Yeah.
Or, you know, because you're having a fear of having a panic attack, which causes a panic attack. But for me, that fear of having a panic attack causes me to shut myself completely down.
Yeah.
To the point where I cannot function. Like, you know what I mean? Where I'm just like, I will just curl up in a ball and cry and then fall into like a period of complete purposelessness, helplessness, and defeatism.
Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, because like when I was in treatment and things like that, one thing that they talked a lot about was like checking in with people. And that's something I do a lot as soon as I get to those feelings. Like, I'll just be like, Chris, I just need to like check in with you real quick and like tell you what's up, because I know that if I keep those things bottled up, that's what's gonna happen, and it doesn't fix it. You know, I'll still feel like crap, I'll still feel depressed or anxious, but like just checking in with someone and having someone else be aware of what's going on,
having outlet for your depression.
Well, it just kind of, you're speaking it out loud.
Yeah,
it helps you rationalize things. It has another person kind of just like validate it a little bit, you know, just kind of be like, okay, I see that you're feeling that way, and then kind of move on, you know?
Right. I think that that's super, super helpful. The times when my depression were, okay, I should preface this by saying that I have never been to the doctor for my depression. I have never been medicated for it by choice. I didn't want to, so I never did it. Probably should have when my depression was at its worst, because it was very, very bad, and it lasted months.
Yeah.
Months of absolutely not doing anything for myself at all.
Well, that's the thing for me, is like, I feel like my medication, although it can sometimes be a pain in the ass and I get horrible withdrawals if I don't take it for a day, but like it's saved me, honestly. Like, if I wasn't taking my medication, Lord knows what I would be. Mm-hmm. Honestly, like, the people who don't take medication and deal with this shit, I'm like, bravo, because as soon as I feel a panic attack happening, I'm like, I'm popping a Xanax. Like,
well, it's, everybody is different. Do you know what I mean? Like, everybody is different. So
right, I'm not, like, shaming you for not taking medication. I think it's, like, amazing that you're able to get through it.
But I mean, like, some people can't get through it without medication. Like, it's different for every person.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's hard to say, like, everybody should be on medication, or you should just be able to deal with this by being in yoga. And it's, like, that's not how...
No.
That's not how mood disorders work.
No, and it's going to be different for each person.
And to be honest, and I've said this many times, like, I didn't do medication. I've never done medication. I do have this weird thing about taking medication, but to be honest, at the time when my depression was at its very, very worst, I probably should have been on medication. Like, it probably really would have helped me.
But it's hard when you, especially as an adult, if you're dealing with these things and you don't have somebody, like, making your doctor's appointments, getting you there.
And a new adult. I was a new adult when this was happening. Like, I didn't know how to take care of myself
at all. No, so the fact that you didn't go to a doctor or get medication doesn't surprise me, because it's like, when I'm there, like, I can't do anything for myself. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, luckily, the past, like, 5 years or so, I've kind of been able to get myself out of my depressive states, because I know that I'm usually going through withdrawal. Mm-hmm. It's usually when I have those times, because I have a stable medication that I take that helps me a lot. So I haven't really had to deal with that. But when I was, like, in my eating disorder, I took myself off medication when I was 18. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Do not take yourself off your medication.
Yeah, you need to seek a medical professional.
Yeah, such a bad idea. And that just made shit so much worse. But I couldn't take care of myself. I couldn't call a doctor. I couldn't do anything. Because
there was no way the time whenever my depression was at its worst that I would have been able to go to a doctor's appointment.
No,
like,
no.
Without somebody taking me there. There's no way.
Exactly.
And I didn't have anyone, which also led to my feelings of, hopelessness and helplessness. And
because you felt like you were just by yourself.
I felt alone, and I felt like I couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
I physically felt like I could not do anything. It was a miracle that I could, like, get up and take my dog out every day. You know, I didn't eat because I couldn't. Like, I didn't clean because I couldn't. Yeah. I would sleep all day. I would take sleeping pills in the middle of the day to sleep.
Yeah, because that's, like, your escape.
Yeah,
because
if I wasn't sleeping, I was miserable. Yeah,
you know. I understand. I completely get it.
So you brought up your medication. What medications have you been on, and what are the pros and cons of that?
Okay, so my first medication that I was on was Paxil. And I remember I was on 10 milligrams, which is nothing. It's really, really low. But I was also 10 years old. And it's interesting because when I started looking at medications for this episode, it was like I looked up Paxil in children. And in 2007, I think I read, or maybe it was 2013. I don't remember. Maybe I wrote it down somewhere, but I'm not looking at it right now. It was basically like the FDA was like, do not give children younger than 18 this pill because the symptoms or the side effects will just like skyrocket, and it is a huge risk of suicidal thoughts and attempts, which is what happened to me.
Isn't I was that like crazy it's with bonkers. Like depression medication can cause you to kill yourself?
Well, because you can have too much of
whatever that chemical is.
You can have too much serotonin. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's that's why medication is so picky, and you need to have so many follow-ups with your doctors because they have to constantly be making sure that it's the exact amount that you need at any given time. And it can change over time. That's why it's such a delicate balance. And yeah, like for me, when I was 12, I'd been on it for about 2 years, I think, and I was in seventh grade, and I told my friend that I was going to kill myself, and I don't remember why. I don't remember. It was probably something stupid, but I said it, and it scared her, and she told a teacher, and then I ended up having, like, I had never met, like, the dean of students or whatever. Like, it was a huge school, and I had to go up to this, like, room, and I was like, what the fuck? They handed me a prayer card and then called my parents in. I went to a very Catholic school. They handed me a prayer card, and they called both of my parents in, which I was really embarrassed about. Like, if it was just my mom, I think I would have been fine, but because I had so many issues with my dad, I was like, I don't want him here. Like, it was really awkward for me, and they were, like, basically, like, Maddie says she's gonna kill herself, and I was like, well, fucking great. And I don't think that they knew that that was because of my Paxil, because I continued to be on it until I was 18 years old.
Well, I think, why would people assume that the thing that's supposed to be making you feel better is making you feel worse?
Right.
You
know what I mean? And they didn't have the full understanding at the time. I think they knew that, like, it could lead to those thoughts, but I think just also having that awareness for me when I was younger, because I do think they knew that. And I was like, okay, then that made me kind of understand myself a little bit better, why I felt crappy sometimes. But I stayed on it until I was like 18, and then I took myself off of it. Don't do it. Really, really, really don't do it.
Do you think that taking your, and we're going to talk about this more when we do an eating disorder episode, but do you think that taking yourself off of your depression medication contributed?
Yes, totally. Well, I started cutting again and burning, and because I couldn't, I had no coping mechanism. Like, I moved to LA and didn't have a doctor, I didn't have a car, I didn't have a way of refilling my medication, and I was like, I'm better, like, I'm good. I don't have to do those things anymore.
Which is very common for people with mental illnesses. Like, you see it all the time with bipolar disorder or schizophrenia in particular, where people will be on medication, be better, and then say, well, I'm better, I don't need my medication anymore.
Exactly, which you're better because you're on your medication.
Exactly.
So, for me, you know, and then other factors too, just physically not being able to get my medication and stuff, you know, so I was like, I'm gonna go off of it, and it's all gonna be good. And then bad shit started happening to me, and I was not dealing with it right, and my old coping mechanisms were like kind of working but not working, you know, the way that they had worked for me in high school. And by coping mechanisms, I mean like hurting myself. It's not a coping mechanism. And then I think it spiraled into my food, and that was kind of like the new thing that kind of felt like it was working, and it was like fixing other things in my life.
And it probably felt less damaging than actually like cutting.
Well, it was invisible.
Yeah,
it's an invisible illness, and it's something that a lot of people complimented me on, and especially being a young actress, and you know, so we'll get into a lot of that more in a few weeks. But yeah, I think that going off medication made me just less stable. Like, there's like a a guy that I dated, and he, like, basically got me to, like, sleep with him and then left me, and that was, like, the first guy besides my boyfriend that I ever slept with, and I lost my fucking shit. Like, I legitimately snapped, and I went batshit crazy, and, like, he was like, what the fuck? And then, like, a few years later, he, like, contacted me and was like, remember when you were, like, fucking crazy? And I'm like, bye. Nope. We're not gonna, like, bring that up again. I couldn't handle anything, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, someone doing something like that to me was, like, I couldn't cope with it at all. And so when I was in treatment the second time, the first time they put me back on Paxil, and then the second time I was in treatment, I was like, this clearly isn't working. This medication is not doing anything for me. By the way, the reason they put me on Paxil is because that's what my mother takes. So there is a lot of genetic reasons why you would give your child the same medication mm-hmm. as the parent.
If it's working for you.
If it's working for the parent, chances are, especially if it's a young child, those are your best odds of giving them a medication mm-hmm. that's the same. So I was like, clearly this isn't working for me. I really just want to try something new. And, you know, in treatment, there's a psychiatrist that comes twice a week. You know, like, all of that was kind of at my disposal. So he put me on Lexapro, which is an SSRI. Let me check my SSRI here. SSRI is selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors. Most commonly prescribed antidepressants typically have fewer side effects, block the absorption of serotonin to the brain, and makes it easier for brain cells to send and receive messages, resulting in better and more stable moods. And then if you're not taking an SSRI, you could be taking an SNRI, which is a serotonin and noradrenaline reuptake inhibitor, and it's used to treat major depressive disorder, mood disorders, and possibly ADHD or OCD, anxiety disorders, menopausal symptoms, fibromyalgia, and chronic neuropathic pain. They raise your serotonin levels and norepinephrine.
Sure. Whatever. Norepinephrine.
Norepinephrine.
I know
Thank
that
you.
One. How do I know that one?
I don't know. Probably from, like, commercials. Two neurotransmitters that play a key role in stabilizing mood. So they're a little bit different, but SSRIs are way more common. And so it says, but also if you have too much serotonin, it could lead to serotonin syndrome. Too much serotonin can lead to excessive nerve cell activity, which could create a deadly collection of symptoms. And that's kind of where we're talking about, you know, mm-hmm. having really bad side effects.
So how has Lexapro been for you?
It's been okay. Yeah. I was on a higher dosage when I was in treatment, and it worked really, really well. I really, really liked it. And then when I went to my asshole doctor that I have now, if anyone has, like, a great doctor in the Burbank area they want to refer me to get me away from this asshole, that would be great. He was like, oh, it can be bad for your heart. But it's really only bad for your heart if you already have, like, heart palpitations. Mm-hmm. So he dropped it 10 milligrams. So I feel like it is helpful because it kind of sort of stabilizes me, but yet I still will have really bad bouts of depression and anxiety. And both Paxil and Lexapro have horrible withdrawal symptoms, mm-hmm. like just the fucking worst. So these are some of the things that can happen to you when you go off your meds. Your digestive system is fucky. You may have nausea, vomiting, cramps, diarrhea, loss of appetite. Blood vessel control. You may sweat excessively, flush, or find hot weather difficult to tolerate. Sleep changes. You may have trouble sleeping and unusual dreams or nightmares. Balance. This is a big one for me. You may be dizzy or lightheaded or feel like you don't quite have your sea legs when walking. That is a big one. Like, literally, I will not take my pills for 24 hours, and I feel like I'm not, like,
your equilibrium's totally off.
It's so off. Like, it feels like I'm not on this planet. Mm-hmm. Like, it's bizarre. Control of movements, another one. You may experience tremors, restless legs, uneven gait, and difficulty coordinating speech and chewing movements. For me, like, my speech is really tough, like talking, and like, or I'll speak very slowly, or, you know, things mm-hmm. like that. That's another big one that fucks with me. Unwanted feelings, obviously. You may have mood swings, feel agitated, anxious, manic, depressed, irritable, or confused, even paranoid or suicidal. You may also experience strange sensations. You may have pain or numbness. You may become hypersensitive to sound or sense a ringing in your ears. You may experience brain zaps, a feeling that resembles an electric shock in your head, or a sensation that some people describe as brain shivers.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's bonkers. Paxil takes about 5 days to be completely out of your body. Lexapro is a little over 6 days. So if I'm, but they only last for like 25 or 26 hours each. That's why you have to take them about the same time every day. I can sometimes miss one pill and like have it be 48 hours and I can be okay. But sometimes I can skip and I'm not okay. If I miss two, I'm out. Like, it's horrible. Like, everything is so much harder for me to do. And I start feeling a lot of these symptoms and it sucks.
Do you think that you'll be on medication for the rest of your life?
Probably.
Yeah?
Yeah. At this point, I'm like, it's working for me, so why? I don't want to go through any of this. And honestly, from what I've been through when I'm not on medication, I don't want to see what that looks like now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care to mess with my psyche. I'm scared of what I would become, I guess. Like,
yeah,
you know, would I not be able to handle things? I already am very overdramatic and very reactive to things while I'm on medication. If I was off medication, dear Lord, help us all. I would be a lonely human being. I would probably lose a lot of my relationships and not cope with things very well at all. So, yeah, I think it's good to keep Maddie medicated for now. I think it's a good idea. I would like to get different medication, though, and I would also really like to get help with when I'm on my period, because, like, those few days before, it doesn't matter if I'm on my medication.
Well, see if you can get on something that... I'm going to my general care physician and having them put me back on progesterone, so...
I just need a new... I need a new doctor. This guy is the fucking worst. So I don't have a psychiatrist that gives me my medication that like is specialized in
that. Who do you
that.
Go to? A general?
I just go to my general doctor because that's what I did when I was younger. I went to a psychiatrist when I was first getting my medication and then it was like working. So my, literally I, for 8 years, I just basically had automatic refills and I would just go to the pharmacy and pick it up. Like, I didn't have to even see a doctor. I would see my doctor, you know, once or twice a year for my checkups and stuff, and they would, you know, quickly just be like, is it, you know, are you noticing any changes with it? No. Okay, great, then we'll just continue with what we're doing. This doctor needs me to see him every 3 months, even though literally nothing changes. And when I go in, he's getting better about this because I've shut him down so many times, but literally he'll sit me down and go, so how's the anorexia going?
What?
Like, those exact words. And I try to explain to him, look, you know, in the world that I'm in, you know, we talk about full recovery from eating disorders. I consider myself recovered. What I'd like to focus on is my anxiety and depression. You know, he asks me about, you know, how that's been going. He'll be like, are you having panic attacks? Yes, no, whatever. And then he starts asking me about my career.
Nope.
He's like, are you making enough money doing that?
Are you kidding me?
Oh, yeah. He acts like he's my dad.
Nope. Shut it down.
It's horrible. And he'll be like, you know, I told him, I started telling him about my podcast, and he just kind of like looks at me like I'm an idiot. And like, he's just the most like underhandedly evil.
No, you need another doctor. You need another doctor.
I know. Like, it's horrible. Like, literally every time I go, I like text Chris the whole time, like how unhappy I am. And he's just like, I swear to God, you better get another doctor.
You need another doctor.
I always like, don't do it.
It's horrible. I know. It's hard. Look, man, I've been saying that I'm going to get back on birth control for how many months now?
Yeah.
And I still haven't done it. It's hard to like make yourself do those like adult things where you have to like.
Well, especially when you're trying to find a new one.
Right.
I'm just like,
I have to go. I haven't been to the doctor in years. Like, that's the reason why I'm putting it off.
I haven't been to the dentist in a really long time.
Oh, girl, I hadn't gone in 5 years. And then I went.
I haven't been that long.
I hadn't gone in 5 years, and I went, and they were like, no cavities. And I was like,
oh, no, I know I have cavities for sure.
At 28, this is like the biggest point of pride that I have in my life is that I've never had a cavity.
Oh, shut up. I have cavities. I have horrible enamel. I get cavities all the time.
You gotta go to the dentist, girl.
Yeah, I know I do. So, yeah, he's the worst. And like, you don't fucking bring up the stressors in life to like prove.
Right.
And then I remember when I was graduating from college, last semester, it was incredibly stressful, and I was using my Xanax more often than usual, because I only get my Xanax, like, once every 3 months, because I don't use them all the time, And so he was asking me, and I was like, I'd really like another prescription because I'm just really, really, like, experiencing more anxiety than usual. And he was basically like, well, we all get a little stressed out sometimes.
No!
It's like, fuck you, you
You're
fucking
You're a doctor.
Fuck.
You don't understand that there's a difference between anxiety and being stressed out. Or
he
anxiety
doesn't understand.
And being nervous.
But also, like, my a woman that I used to work for had a fucking broken rib and went to this guy, and he wouldn't even give her an x-ray.
Uh-uh.
So...
Bye. He's great.
He's great.
Someone else.
Yeah.
So we are coming up on an hour here, but kind of to wrap, do you have anything else you want to add?
No.
Okay.
I think that, you know, as the weeks are going, we'll just keep chatting.
We will. Yeah. And we'll definitely have, I know we're kind of focusing on it a little bit right now because it's Mental Health Month, but we will definitely do episodes periodically talking about things to do with mental health because it's very important.
Yeah.
The only thing that I kind of wanted to add here at the end is... We talked a little bit about a medication and the pros and cons. And like I said, when I was going through the worst of it, in hindsight, I feel like I probably should have been on medication. It probably would have helped me. I didn't do it because I have a weird aversion to medication. If you have a weird aversion to medication and you just, the cons outweigh the pros for you for whatever reason, and you feel like you can't do it, there are things that you can do that are alternatives to
definitely
being on a medication. There are things that have been proven to help, like go to a therapist, do work on breathing exercises, do maybe look into mindfulness meditation or yoga or some kind of physical activity that will kind of raise those endorphin levels in your body.
Definitely.
I know that there's been a lot of talk about marijuana and CBD as a treatment for depression and anxiety. I will say that... One of the reasons why I do not smoke weed is because it raises my anxiety levels.
Yeah, it's different for everybody.
It's different for everyone. For me, it makes me more anxious, so I will not use it to quell my anxiety, but it could work for you.
Yep.
Or CBD could work for you. CBD oil or some other form could be beneficial for you. There are alternatives if you are looking for ways to combat your anxiety or your depression and you don't feel like medication is the right path for you, but I would suggest seeking out someone to help you make those decisions.
Yes, and... Also, to kind of close out, I want to give a few hotline numbers for people.
Absolutely.
These are some free crisis hotline numbers. The National Alliance on Mental Illness is 1-800-950-NAMI, and the number is 6264. The National Suicide Prevention Lifeline is 1-800-273-TALK, or 8255. Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration helpline number is 1-800-662-HELP or 4357. And the teen line is 1-310-855-HOPE or 1-800-TLC-TEEN 852-8336. So those are just a few hotlines. If you want more or anything more specific, it is a Google search away. Those are always really, really helpful when you feel like you don't have someone, like, you know, I can just go into the next room and talk to somebody.
Right.
If you don't have someone like that, that's a good place to go.
Yeah, I think it's really important to know that you're not alone. I think it's something like 1 in 6 people in the United States suffer from some form of anxiety or depression.
Yeah. Oh, and also don't play the game where, like, if you're helping somebody who's depressed, don't play the game of, like, oh, I know more about that than you. Mine is worse than yours. Because I've totally done that.
Right.
I mean, I've experienced that before where it's like, oh, well, you'll never have it as bad as me. Or, oh, I understand. Trust me, mine is way worse.
Right. And listen, as much as I believe in the power of thought, and I believe that for me personally, kind of making this decision to try and be better. Like, I actually did make a decision where I was just like, stop repeating this tape in your brain of everything is terrible, you're bad, you're ugly, you're worthless.
Yeah.
I did make a decision to do that and put a conscious effort to feel better.
Yeah.
Don't tell people that they can just feel better. Because when you're in the midst of it, until you are able to either put yourself in a place like that, or get on the right medication, or do, you know, this, that, and the other, to get healthy, that is not going to help them to tell them that, well, just be happy. Just be happy doesn't help. It doesn't help.
Yeah. Give them, you know, constructive phone calls, doctor information. Mm-hmm.
Be supportive.
Things like that. Yeah, yeah. If you feel like you need to say or do something, those are good things to do. And also for people who are supporting people with anxiety and depression, you don't always have to be 100% involved, because that's taxing on you. You know, if you feel like it's something that's unhealthy for you to be supporting somebody else, that's when you can help veer them toward someone who's a professional, because that you don't have to put that on yourself.
Right.
Don't feel like you have to be that person's lifeline.
You're never responsible 100% for somebody else's mental health, as much as it can feel that way.
Yeah.
You can be a support for them and be a guide for them.
And if it becomes too much for you, that's okay, because you have to look after your mental health as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. So we look forward to talking more about mental health this month. Mm-hmm. It's something that I think is very close to both of our hearts. And you can always go ahead and email us with any issues if you're having a tough time. I know Madigan and I have both experienced difficult times. If you just need somebody to talk to and feel like you don't have anybody and you don't feel comfortable calling a hotline, you just want to talk to someone, you can email us. We're totally open to receiving that. And our email is neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com. You can find us on Instagram at Angry Neighborhood Feminist or on Twitter at Yamph Podcast. Please join our Facebook group, because I feel so alone and posting in that group.
I know. Oh, and that would be such a great place for people to also post about things and get support from other people.
Mm-hmm.
Please join it. I know one day it's going to be more than it is now.
Yeah.
But I'm enjoying it
as it is right now. But I totally look forward to having people kind of have conversations in there and join our community.
Support each other. And it's going to be beautiful.
Yeah. And that's a gorgeous place to do it. So please, please find us on Facebook and
join our group.
Yeah.
Also, just reminding you that you can literally find us wherever you listen to your podcasts. We're going to push Radio Public on you a little bit. We're at $6.60, Keegan. We are rolling in the dough. Oh, we are just like living it up, living our best lives. So listen on Radio Public if you feel like it. That'd be great. We love you guys. And with that, we encourage you to rage on.
Rage on.
Bye. With my sexy voice.